you know, between you and the reality of what was going on in Iraq, about WMD, you had Wolf Blitzer on CNN, you had Judith Miller in the New York Times. And these people were taking the cooked intelligence and putting it between you and between decision makers and the real facts.
Yep.
Now, looking back, everybody goes, oh my God, the five primary, you know, facts that we relied on to invade Iraq all turned out to be absolute fixed intelligence.
Well, you know, Gates actually gave an advice to John DeCamp, the man who outed that Franklin cover-up, and that what many of these people were involved in, believe it or not. There's other subjects, but John DeCamp told me that Gates told him, what you got to do is come out and tell your whole story, or you're not going to be around very long. And he also said that you're going to find out that no one believes you. And he said the people you need to convince most are the people closest to you, because even they won't believe you.
That's right. Well, that's how this operates. You work in that space between the facts and what people. And this is the great challenge, because if you imagine you've got a jury, you're the lawyer. I'm defending you on some serious charge, and I know you're innocent. You are indeed innocent, and the facts prove you're innocent. Unless we can persuade that jury, you're innocent. You're guilty.
Yeah.
Therein lies the great challenge here, because we know the facts that, you know, money is smarter than people is not correct. We know that if you let money work its unfettered, you know, wisdom around the planet, you're going to create oligarchies and destroy the environment and what's going on. Yet we continue to embrace it because we've been led to believe this is what we should do, regardless of the facts in front of us. And that's the subtlety of this. That's why people have to take their own responsibility for this and begin to step in and see how this is embedded in their own belief system and their own behavior.
Well, you know, go ahead.
That's how you begin to turn this around.
Well, here's the interesting thing about all this. A lot of people in this group that we're trying to talk to right now, we're not trying to go after the undereducated masses of people who may or may not understand economics as it's being played out in the world. But rather, I've always tried to attract opinion shapers, people who once converted to the truth in this battle would be able to enunciate the facts in an intelligible way with people. And what we need to do is to start having a migration of people with capacity, because it's not numbers necessarily that are going to win this fight, but rather opinion shapers moving throughout the society, reshaping that misbegotten education we all have.
Well, there's a part of this that people can relate to. The geopolitics and the finance are a little more obscure for most people. But, for example, there's a professor at University of California, Santa Barbara, named William Robinson, who was targeted by the Anti-Defamation League after he posted on his website and distributed a photo essay that had been circulating for weeks online.
Yep.
That was critical of Israeli policy in Gaza.
Yep.
The Anti-Defamation League came after him. One of his professors leaked the information to the Anti-Defamation League. They got a local rabbi involved. Suddenly the chancellor is getting calls from people all over California threatening to take money out of the university, threatening to hold back bequests, all this sort of thing. It was a brilliantly timed silencing campaign, an intimidation campaign, and it went on for 4.5 to 5 months while a newly elected president in the throes of a murderous incursion into Gaza was sorting through what he's going to do with U.S. Israeli policy. So I think people can relate, and keep in mind his students wanted to put together a website and mount it a defense. When I met with him, he asked me straight up, he said, are they going to kill me? This professor with kids, he's tenured, you know, he's asking if these guys are going
to
kill him.
They have been known to. You know that as well.
Well, this is how this works. It's meant to intimidate, it's meant to silence.
Yeah.
The Anti-Defamation League made sure that case on that one high-profile university got exposure not only nationwide, but worldwide. So where you typically find protest and at least people questioning things is on campuses. That silenced academics worldwide.
Yes.
It was a very successful campaign. Finally, 100 professors and 20 departments had stood up and said, this is going to end. And the chancellor didn't end it. It was his number two finally stopped all the proceedings. And keep in mind, Robinson's Jewish.
Well, you know, the interesting part, the component of what you're saying right now, I remember back in my study, when I was doing my studies at NYU, I had a professor named Dr. Levy presenting to me the history of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars. And of course, no mention was ever made of the financing of Jacobins and the financing of the Huguenots and the rest of the people coming out of the Swiss area, and how banker money, Rothschild money, was involved in this revolution at the top. And then it's finally dawned on me in retrospect that this person was in a position of preeminence in the research area. Harvard graduate, doctorate from Harvard or Princeton, even, I'm not sure. But she was almost a gatekeeper for the truth never coming out about the truth within the French Revolution. So they place within professions and within academia very important blockages to ever having facts seen the light of day.
No, that's definitely the case, and that's we found that the research has indicated that. And I mean, to give you one example, it happens in the pop culture domain. A lot of people have been very entranced by a film by Michael Moore called Fahrenheit 9/11.
Yes, yeah.
One of these power of association things, because there's a Bin Laden on the Carlisle board, and because George Herbert Walker Bush is on the Carlisle board, therefore Iraq is all about Bush oil. This kind of nonsense. Before that movie came into the theaters, Michael Eisner at Disney and Harvey Weinstein at Miramax, a subsidiary, had this dust-up, this sort of dispute about how the film was going to be distributed. And that was on the business pages of every newspaper around the country about twice a week. It must have been a variety probably every day. An enormous dust-up, right, between these two major players in Hollywood. By the time that film got into the theaters, it opened the first time a documentary had opened in that many theaters nationwide. And these guys did not pay a cent for the PR. They just created out of nothing, and Michael Moore just created that, power of association, nonsensical theme, just literally out of nothing.
And his agent, just by for a sidebar issue here, his agent was Rahm Emanuel's brother.
Oh, perfect. Well, there you go. So that's how you do it. That's the enormous role that pop culture plays in this, to help prepare your mind to displace facts of which you can be induced to believe.
Well,
everywhere you look, there's the power of association being used.
Yeah.
And everywhere you look in the background, you will find this same network.
Well, and they're doing this within family structures as well. And that the building block of any healthy society is the strength of a family. And what we've seen is the erosion of family values, but more than that, pop culture again has made it seem that the next generation doesn't want to have associative strength coming from family. They want it to come from brand recognition or social, but they have absolutely perverted the entire structure of family worldwide. And it's the American model coming out of the Hollywood and American media being exported globally. And I'm over here in France watching the garbage on the television coming from America. I'll give you one example. Friends, the show that is so popular for so long, Friends, you'll note that throughout that program, every third or fourth show, they would talk about how cool it was to have free pornography on their television. That they got free porn on their TV, and did you rent some porn films for the weekend? You see, and what we know about is that the porn industry is controlled by the same group, interestingly enough, but it also served to destroy relationships between men and women, to cheapen the association in families, and it was again a psyop leaking into our lives. And then, interesting, recently, the character Joey comes out on a publicity thing, representing himself through Friends. Is promoting the Lubavitch on a telethon to try to raise millions of dollars across America for the Shabbat Lubavitch.
Yeah, this is the challenge. I mean, the Chinese take a lot of umbrage because they were blocking our films coming into China. Now, this crowd has been active in China back to the Silk Road, as best the research suggests.
Yep.
But they are more interested in trying to preserve some semblance of Chinese society than allowing the film companies to bring their sex and violence into China. And so, but in the framing of the WTO, then that looks like you're against free trade. Are you against free trade, or are you against this point of view that has no moral perspective to it at all? And that's the, you know, other than money, and therein lies a challenge for people to get that there could actually be a common source for these many dysfunctions. And that's where this research, points. Yes, there is a common source to this.
Well, you know, both of us have knowledge and the ability to really dissect the financial part of this, Jeff, and there's nobody in the country right now who's not concerned, or the world for that matter, who's not concerned about their financial health right now. I mean, if you've got a pulse and you live in any city in the Western world, you are frightened to death about what you're watching financially happen around the world. You want to talk a little bit about what you know has happened at the hands of this group, and what you see coming in your estimation from what you've researched?
Yeah, I think what you're finding is we're in the middle of the third in a series of what we call pump and dumps. You pump the market up, you pull cash out the top, the market dumps, and you're the one sitting there with cash to buy assets at the bottom. The first one was a savings and loan pump and dump. It cost us about $150 billion. The second was the dot-com pump and dump, and that case is where you really tried out the notion of having analysts who would pump up stock. For example, Time Warner's stock was pumped up to about 130 times price to earnings. Time Warner then went down to Ted Turner in Atlanta and said, you thought your company was worth $1 billion or $2 billion. We can show you it's worth $10 billion because we're going to give you this currency called Time Warner stock that we just printed on Wall Street. And Ted Turner said, isn't that great? He took the deal. He got the stock, they put him on the board, and then the stock lost about 85% of its value, and Wolf Blitzer ended up as the primary announcer. So they got control. This crowd got control of that really essential global news network. And the most recent one is the one we're now seeing. Now keep in mind that and this is when people really get this, they're going to be more than just outraged. But keep in mind the primary driver of this is the funds that were set aside for the 78 million baby boomers. That $17 trillion or so is largely money, the enormous part of it, at a $150 billion a year taxpayer subsidy. That's the funds that are driving this. So when that pump, you know, started up, it was largely those funds pumping it up. When that thing began to dump, it was largely those funds going back down. And you're finding, for example, Sam Zell, they call him the grave dancer. He's the one that was the primary bottom feeder for the savings and loans. He now owns the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, about 30 other media outlets.
Yeah.
And those are all money losers, and I don't think this crowd cares whether they make money or not. You just want to be the people in between to shape the message.
That's right. That's right.
Where this crowd is enormously dominant and has been for quite a long time.
Well, then we also are watching funded pension plans that came out of these larger corporations, such as, we'll use GM for the example, where they forced it into a bankruptcy, used their influence within the Washington elite to force that company into a situation. Well, I think it even goes beyond that, Jeff, and maybe you'll agree. Back when I was scratching my head here, knowing full well the world was building mid to small size cars, and America was pumping their cars up to the size of small buildings and putting wheels on them. And I knew that this was, and now in hindsight, looking at it, it seems to me that what they were doing is destroying the American car industry's future. And basically now, of course, that car company has gone into a receivership of sorts, and they're reemerging, telling 50,000 retirees that you're either going to get a lower or possibly no pension paid to you in your retirement. And it's astonishing that they could do something like this, but they've done it. And they did it over here in France to a company called Alstom. Where the company didn't have any contracts, it was building the TGV fast trains over here in France, and the company's value was about in the 30s euros at the time, and they ran the company down all the way to it was at 60 centimes per share. And everybody and their grandmother was throwing away the stock in a desperate race. And when it reached 40 cents, 40 centimes a share, who steps in but the criminal oligarchs in the banking industry, Rothschild and the rest, and they bought it up on pennies on the dollar, and it reemerged with all kinds of new contracts, got rid of a bunch of pension liabilities by government mandate, and then the company's stock ended up running up to 100 euros from 40 centimes. And I watched this happen. And I mean, at the time I saw this all happening, it was stomach turning. And they've done this over and over again. They've got many different ways of doing it, but they've done it repeatedly.
Well, if you take the start view, which you tend to take, and which is reflected on your website, you'll find that as 7 years as counsel to the Finance Committee, on three separate occasions, we directed the Treasury to define the difference between debt and equity, owing money and having money. You think we could make that distinction?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until I went into investment banking when I realized, of course, that there are very gradations. It's very hard to do.
Yeah.
But keep in mind that debt does in time become equity. You don't take out a mortgage except because you know as you pay the debt down, the equity in your home builds up, right?
That's right.
So this crowd has known how to use debt for centuries. So debt will in time become equity. Well-structured debt will in time become equity. And as it becomes equity, it becomes available as collateral to secure more debt. So you do that over and over and over enough times, and suddenly you got these families who understand this process, fully understanding that. When I was at the Finance Committee, as Finance Committee Counsel, when I came aboard, we had about $900 billion in total federal securitized debt. Ronald Reagan, the fiscally conservative Republican, was running against Jimmy Carter, the fiscally profligate Democrat. And my first year in the Finance Committee, Reagan comes up with this tax bill that had an $872 billion price tag. And that, we're literally doubling the debt inside of 1 year by this fiscal conservative. And he is a product of this phenomenon. He was created by Jules Stein and Lou Wasserman out of Cleveland. He was put in GE Theater. This warm, fuzzy presence got branded, put in his head of the Screen Actors Guild, and just kind of nurtured, like Schwarzenegger, which you mentioned earlier.
Yep.
You kind of nurture these people so they're right position at the right time, and you put them in office. And he was a warm, fuzzy, lovely guy, and it was really the people in between, again, is what your listeners need to learn how to see, and how they are there regardless of whether you think these are Democrats or Republicans. It's the people in between who are framing this, and framing it in plain sight.
Yeah.
That's why you need to be able to see how this works, the power of association, those types of skills are finely honed. The ability, how old is the skill with which people displace facts with beliefs?
Well, and I constantly ask my listeners when I tell somebody some new information, I say, this requires you to suspend your disbelief. But here's the next one I want to go on to, this phenomenon called Obama. Of course, I know a lot about the Crown and Pritzker families up in Chicago. I know that their association to Brofman is undeniable. And I also know that where you're sitting right now, that same association of the senator from your state goes back to those people as well. You want to talk a little bit about, and it's no surprise that he was the opponent for this particular phase of criminality, because all of the orchestrating factors behind the scenes were all already set in motion long before these people even emerged.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's and you'll see there's a chapter in the book called "Would Obama Be Better?" And the first paragraph says, look, this is a product of the West Side Chicago Ashkenazi outfit. Penny Pritzker, one of his top three fundraisers, is the granddaughter of Abe, who was a lawyer for the mob in the 20s.
Yeah.
Crown from the Palo settlement, Krinsky originally, it was 25% of General Dynamics. The third was George Soros, who will come back to perhaps another time.
Yeah.
But he is a product of this phenomenon, and that doesn't mean he is a conscious product of this phenomenon. He is what you would call a classic asset, as is John McCain. Whatever Barack Obama's needs and whatever his personality is, an asset is someone who's been profiled in sufficient depth that you know that if you put him in a time, place, and circumstance that you create, you know within an acceptable range of probabilities that they will perform consistent with their profile. In the case of John McCain, I'm living in his first congressional district in Tempe, Arizona. John McCain had an electable CV. They put Jim Hensley's daughter onto him, 18 years as junior, they knew his profile, brought him back to Arizona, put him into a House seat 4 years before they knew Barry Goldwater was going to retire.
Mm-hmm.
He is a classic asset. Now, what drives him is anybody's guess, but this crowd knows precisely what drives him.
Well, we know that Brofman was giving him exclusive distribution contracts for alcohol in the Southwest through his wife's site.
Well, it's an interesting story there, because when when the National Crime Syndicate was formed in 29 in Atlantic City, the year before that, a guy named Gus Greenbaum was shot here in 1928.
Yeah.
If you fast forward to 1947, Beaudry Siegel was shot by Murder, Inc. because he was skimming the skim.
Yeah.
They then moved Gus Greenbaum up to Vegas, and they need somebody to replace him. That was a guy named Kemper Marley, who ran the mob here for years. He's the guy that hired Jim Hensley and his brother. Jim and Jim's brother took the fall on two separate liquor violations for Kemper Marley. And lo and behold, Jim Hensley ended up with the statewide Budweiser Anheuser-Busch distributorship. The original liquor monopoly, which was controlled by Kemper Marley, did come out of the Bronfman family. That's the original Prohibition era bootlegging, where much of organized crime was capitalized with Prohibition, and it also set up a nationwide distribution system because you had 24 exclusive territories to keep these guys from killing each other, with five of them around New York City. So it was the 29 National Crime Conference in Atlantic City that set it up, but the truth is the territories weren't locked into cement until 1931 at the Franconia Hotel in Manhattan, which was a Jews-only enclave. And one of the Jewish guys who attended said, "I don't want to work with all these, you know, WOPs," or whatever his derogatory name was for Italians. So Beaudry Siegel and Meyer Lansky and this crowd handled that as you'd expect. They went out and killed the guy. They said, "Any other questions?" And so you've had this Italian and Sicilian face on organized crime ever since then.
Well, and that's right, and they've used it as cover, and you'll even see it in popular culture again with the guy being subservient to Soprano being this Jewish financier, and they make it seem as though he's only ancillary in the story rather than the man at the top.
Right, exactly, and that's the way this works. The people at the top these days, people do not even know their names. A lot of them will be identified in this in sequels in this series, but they are they're very prominent, and they do hold the same ethnicity and the same sort of background, and they are considered very legitimate businessmen. And this is part of the challenge of this, how do you out these people and out them in such a fashion that the evidentiary trail is strong enough that you can do what needs to be done, which is realize that this is giving aid and comfort to an enemy. This is adhering to an enemy. These are capital crimes.
Well, Jeff, you know, my website has 40-plus books and documents on it that does that through history. And what my premise has always been that is if I could show an unbroken chain of evidence through history to the present, and anybody spends the time and intellectual capital to understand it, they're going to come to a conclusion that can't be dissuaded from. And that's where we are today. You know, I've taken a lot of heat for it, and in fact, I've had all kinds of threats and, you know, financial problems personally because of all the work I'm trying to do. But, you know, like you, I'm going to assume I don't want my children and my grandchildren or even me, if I live long enough, to have a world where freedom is only a concept that I have trouble even picturing in my mind. And that's where we're heading. You know, as the fog has cleared, I realized I've never lived in freedom, but the fact is I still yearn for it.
Well, we have now proxy for freedom. We have financial freedom. We have market freedom. And so we subscribe to that, and we think, I mean, right now, we're founded on the basis of the pursuit of happiness. And right now, if your 401k balance is less than what it was, or your pension balance is less than what it was, you're not happy. So you're worried. You're concerned. And so we've gotten ourselves so embedded into this financial model that we identify with that, you know, rightly it is called the Washington Consensus. It is the American consensus that money should just simply be allowed to work its will worldwide.
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
Yeah.
What
yeah.
Subculture within a subculture within a subculture within a subculture would have embedded that in education, think tanks, media, politics, pop culture, so we would genuinely believe it. That's where people need to understand that. That's at the level at which this works. This is a form of mind warfare, and it's deeply embedded, and it's hard for people to see. It's clearly got a component of deception in it, but the counterpart is self-deceit. You have to have both sides of that, and if people can get the self-deceit side of it, that will help better see the deception, and that's what this works about.
Well, I don't know what you think about the work we've done today, but I think it's just fantastic, actually. And there are few times on the French Connection that I get to speak to somebody with your level of quality. I do have Mohamed Rafik, who has nailed this conspiracy on the financial side, you know, having his background and so forth. But we are in a pitched battle. It's certainly not certain of the outcome, although over time I think these people are in trouble. It's now, I think, for me, the real job is to try to get the word out in a way that we can begin to minimize suffering that I know is going to... It's certainly already there for a lot of people, especially if you've lost your home or lost your mortgage, or you're already homeless or trying to bunk in with your parents, and they're now in financial trouble. And all this, you lost your job. Suffering is beginning to mount worldwide. The French society is breaking down in many respects. I mean, there are companies and business people being kidnapped for trying to lay off their workers, or they're threatening to pour toxic sludge into the Seine because they don't want to be laid off. So we're seeing suffering everywhere. My job now, during the process of waking up for everybody, is to try to ameliorate the suffering I know is on its way. Do you have any comments about that, and what your take is on trying to get this out there, and what you need to do?
Once they realize this has a common source, and that source is embedded in their own belief system and their own framing of how they view their world, that'll help enormously. I think a lot of this wealth that's been accumulated by criminal means is going to need to be, taken back and given to those who actually earned it. That's going to be a huge challenge. And you're also going to have to shift to how you what you use as a means of exchange in order to, lubricate your economy. The idea that all money must originate in debt is guaranteed to feed the system. It not only creates a carriage trade, which ends up with a very heavy lien on the system on an ongoing basis, it also pulls money out of communities. And so you find that a lot of the responses are people looking at more of how you do complementary currencies, how you secure currencies of real assets rather than debt, how you begin to catalyze, exchange in the community through information rather than waiting around to figure out how people are going to generate Federal Reserve notes in order to make a purchase in their community. That's where this is going. A lot of the fiscal expense for communities, the two biggest fiscal expenses are healthcare and education, every community worldwide.
Yep.
And a lot of those expenses can be handled with information technology. People can trade services, they can do multi-point barter. There's lots of creative things that were done in the Great Depression. We had over 5,000 complementary currencies in the United States during the Great Depression.
Yep.
So I think there's now a movement ramping up to head back in that direction to begin to displace it. And the challenge is to make sure this time around we keep that in place rather than have this crowd again displace that sort of dispersed, form of power with this concentrated form of power, which has been the problem for a very long time.
Well, we've come to the end of our hour here, Jeff, and of course you are... more than welcome to come back and do more work with the French Connection. I'm proud to have had you on here. You are a very learned man. You are well spoken, and you are you're measured in your presentation, and that's not always the case. And quite frankly, I've had my days on this radio broadcast where my blood started boiling, and I've gotten angry. And I got to tell you, some of this stuff makes me sick, and especially when I start seeing the damage that's been done to children and to families, I just get angry. And
Look, keep in mind, this is an agent provocateur model. What you do is you provoke the mark, and then the mark responds. The agent provocateur fades into the background, and the response of the mark becomes the issue. The United States looks like they're crazy and irrational because of our response to the provocation of a mass murder on U.S. soil.
Yep.
And it works at the individual level as well. People have to be, you don't have to be cold-blooded, but you got to be cold about this. You got to say, let's get to the facts. Let's cut out the opinions, cut out the adjectives even. Let's just simply describe how this works, educate each other into how this works, so we can begin to displace this phenomenon. And it is bad. It's a phenomenon. And it can be done. And that's the good news.
Well, you know, the other side of it, between now and the next time we speak on air, I hope I can urge you to look into maybe the medical crimes being committed, and even the social crimes such as the exploitation of children. And we've even got white slavery going on. We've got drugs coming out of Afghanistan by the metric ton on a daily basis, and drug addiction and sickness coming around. And when you look behind the roots of it all goes back to the same group. It is astonishing that it's so pervasive and so and all-encompassing, but it's real. And I try to be calm about it at times, but I got to tell you, after 5 years of doing these broadcasts, I've done over 850 hours of broadcasts. And in some of those broadcasts, Jeff, I just tell you, I get tired of it. I never thought I would last this long. And, you know, I started out doing this by calling into a radio show, outraged that George Bush was doing something, and that's how I got started.
Well, this is organized crime going to scale, and when people realize that's what this is, and when they realize that they are the mark in a fraud, no one likes to be played for the fool.
Yep.
And we've been played for the fool.
We have.
And once people get that they are being played, and their children are being played, and their children are being manipulated, and they are being manipulated 24/7 by allowing this crowd to take over media and pop culture and the think tanks and politics, they will wake up, because this is not what we agreed to. We just thought this is what we agreed to, And that can change. So with education, with people getting the word out like this, that can change.
Well, I'm very proud to have had you on, and we are going to do this, I hope, again soon, if you're willing.
I look forward to it.
Well, you know, Jeff, I don't know what your experience was on the French Connection, but I hope you found me to be a good interviewer. I try to be up on every subject. Sometimes, I've actually been duped a few times here. I got to be honest with you. Just the amount of information and the stuff that I put through, in front of my face here, trying to be a consolidator of all of the facts is a tough slog, and I don't always get it right. But when I find out I'm wrong, I admit it. And
I think you did the right thing and put in a historical context. That's very helpful to people. So my hat's off to you and appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Jeff, and I look forward to our next meeting. And ladies and gentlemen, Jeff Gates, his name of his book is Guilt by Association. The name of his website is criminalstate.com. You will find a link to his site on my site so that you can get to his information and to his book. And Jeff, I hope maybe you can put the IamTheWitness.com on your website so we can jointly help each other get larger numbers in the information search mode.
I sure appreciate the time. It's been great.
Thank you very much. Until the next time, ladies and gentlemen, please take care of your families. And this is Dale Bradford Smith telling you all, please, be well. Bye-bye now.